Ah, yeah, that was Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers with Moanin', which we all should be doing today, given the news out of Washington. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Tuesday, December the 18th, and there's a lot on our plate today, so let's get started. All eyes are fixed on Washington, as the White House has just rejected the Republicans' latest version, or more correctly, the latest counterversion of a budget proposal. With the drama of a suspense movie, the nation is waiting for an announcement by President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner that they have hashed out finally a budget before the hammer falls at the end of the year. But what would that final product look like? And what will it mean for the rest of us? Does it mean that we ought to suit up to dive off of this fiscal cliff? Rebecca Theis is a federal budget policy analyst with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Her areas of expertise include federal budget policy, tax policy, social security and pensions, and public investment. And she joins us now. Thank you, Rebecca, for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, how do you read the latest development?
Well, you know, there's certainly a lot to dive in here, but I think I'll just start by saying we're beginning to see, I think, what many of us expected to see all along, which is President Obama and House Republicans coming to some sort of an agreement over what to do on the number of policies that are basically coming to a head at the very beginning of 2013. And so what we're seeing is both John Boehner and President Obama making some concessions, both angering their bases. I think today a lot of the coverage I'm seeing is on Obama potentially moving, to okay Social Security benefit cuts, as part of a deal. But, Boehner, on the other hand, is saying that he may agree to higher tax rates on very wealthy people making over $1 million. Obama's trying to push him further, but we're seeing a little bit more consensus between the two of those people.
But from an economic theory point of view, are these negotiations in any way following sound economic theory?
I do not think that they are. Our economy is still, mired in a very weak recovery, and we absolutely need the best policies possible to bring us back to full employment and to bring about a strong recovery. The framework of this entire debate has basically been hijacked, I believe, by the right and by the center to be about deficit reduction, where it should be about job creation and economic recovery.
Well, in a way, I mean, let's stick with this for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that a bad thing? Why is it a bad thing to focus on debt reduction as a primary objective?
Sure. That is a great question. And I understand why the American people would be confused about this topic as well. You know, we hear from so many different outlets that deficits and growing debt are our number one problem. That is not true. Right now, our number one problem is the economy, and it is the vast number of unemployed people who don't have the money to go out and buy things, which means that businesses aren't selling their goods and services, which keeps the economy in a very weak cycle. And economic theory supports the notion that during depressed times, greater fiscal support is what's needed to help an economy recover. So by that I basically mean if the government can pump the money that the private sector is not producing during this time into the economy, that can help businesses thrive, and it can help people retain jobs, be tax-paying citizens, be consumers. And so, you know, so economists believe, you know, fairly, a fair number of economists believe that during recessions, deficits must increase. The private sector has completely pulled back during difficult times, so the public sector needs to step in and make up for that, which means higher government spending. And then as the economy recovers, that spending decreases, deficits shrink, and we operate a little bit more normally, if you will. But, you know, we've seen trillion-dollar deficits for the last 3 years, and that's not a bad thing. These are the types of deficits we should be operating in the worst recession seen since the Great Depression.
So if they don't tackle it as a primary objective, don't they further, isn't that the argument that if you don't deal with the deficit as a number one issue, as opposed to anything else, mm-hmm. because, you know, the issue really is, as they were running, as these candidates were running, the issue always was the economy. Now the issue is the deficit. So we moved from position to another, and one would assume that Barack Obama, as a candidate, would have been informed by his economic advisors, yes, the issue is the economy. Is there a surprise that he seems to have switched and now says the deficit agreed with the Republicans that
right.
the deficit is the number one issue?
Well, you know, I think that we've seen Obama go back and forth on these things during his entire presidency. For instance, I'll point you to the big things that stand out in my mind are the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, you know, a very big stimulus package that was passed soon after he took office, and this was a direct response to the recession. And then also you saw President Obama put together this commission on deficits, this fiscal commission that absolutely went against what he was trying to tell the American people, which was this, you know, a recovery and more spending is necessary in order for our country to be pulled out of this recession, in order for us to create jobs. And then on the other hand, he turns around and says, well, we need to look at our deficits. And I think that was a very confusing stance for him to take. I think it did nothing to help clarify the debate. And so now that, you know, that we're seeing him focus on, you know, on deficits to a certain extent, I'm not entirely surprised. However, I do want to give him a little bit of benefits here. I think he is very much looking out for the American people and very much looking out for our recovery. And that's apparent in the first sort of package deal that he offered to John Boehner, which was a solid, solid package, one that, you know, did end up bringing deficits down in the long run, but that was primarily focused on creating jobs, boosting the recovery, and spending on projects that would, you know, that would help our recovery. He wanted to extend unemployment benefits, extend the payroll tax holiday, and then have stimulus on top of that. And so I really think that Obama did a pretty good job staking his position there. He's moved towards the center in his negotiations with Boehner, but, you know, I don't think that he's ever lied about his intentions there. He's always said, I want to work with the other side. I'm a bipartisan president.
Could you explain before, I want to go through what the Economic Policy Institute had recommended earlier this year as a framework, but could you explain how it is? Because people are, you know, it's hard for people to put their minds around this. Could mm-hmm. you explain how it is that economists could be so confident that infusing money, that is spending more money, actually is a good thing, and that they're fairly confident that if the money is spent now to stimulate the economy, it will be regained within a fairly short time, and they would be able to tame the increased deficit in a fairly short time?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, you know, because it's not necessarily an intuitive point. You often hear people say, well, if a family is having a difficult time, they tighten their belt. You know, they spend less at the grocery store, they don't buy new clothes, they really tighten their belt. And so they expect the government to operate in the same way, but in fact, as you suggested, the government doesn't work the way that a normal household does. You know, in difficult times, there are various policies that can be put into place that do have a solid impact on the economy. And I guess the best way to explain this is that these policies come with what are called fiscal multipliers, which basically mean they're bang per buck. You know, so for example, spending on unemployment benefits during a recession. This has a very high fiscal multiplier, which means that it goes a long way in the economy. And if you think about it, that makes sense. If you give somebody $400 in benefits for a month who's unemployed, likely they're going to spend that entire amount. They're not going to sit on it. They're not going to save it because they're in a difficult time. They need those benefits. So they're going to go out. They're going to put gas in their car. They're going to buy food for their family. They're going to buy clothes for their children. That means more businesses in their community stay open and stay healthy because they're doing business while other people are tightening their belts and not buying clothes, not buying as much gas for their car, not buying as much food. So these, you know, this type of spending by the government creates its own sort of ripple effect. And there are different, basically different impacts for different types of policies. Unemployment benefits have one of the highest impacts in the economy. Infrastructure spending is another one that has very high impacts because basically a community or, you know, a state or a city will get funding, they'll hire workers, they'll buy materials, and they'll begin working on a project. So that's something that impacts that community or begins to impact that community almost immediately. You've got people working. You've got people then who earn a paycheck, who buy lunch at their neighborhood diner, which then keeps another chef employed, and the ripple effects go on and on. So you see, you know, positive impacts with a whole slew of policies. The payroll tax holiday is another one. You know, while I'm not particularly a big fan of that policy, it does have, positive economic impact. It puts another $1,500 per year in your average worker's bank account. And for the people who are not making a ton of money, not saving a ton of money, they go out and they spend that, which helps the economy. So when we look at various policies and how they impact the economy during a recession, it's important to look at, you know, basically how those policies are, how their impacts are measured. And the Congressional Budget Office and various other economic advisors put out numbers based on these policies that are fairly accurate, that have proven to be fairly accurate.
Why isn't this budget process, this negotiation process, why isn't it open?
You know, that's another great question. I think that we went through, the way I look at it is we went through a much more open process during the debt ceiling negotiations of August 2011, July and August 2011. And that was a very messy process that did not reflect well on our country, did not reflect well on our leaders, and ultimately ended up, if you'll remember, with the downgrading of U.S. debt by, I think it was Standard & Poor's. And this time around, part of the reason why I think they're less open is damage control. You've got Obama and John Boehner, the two of them working behind the scenes, basically together trying to figure out what to do on a number of different policies. You don't have really many other people in the room. You know, I've heard that Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, they're involved with, I guess, getting briefed on what's going on, but they're not very involved in the decision-making process. And I think part of that is just so that there's more damage control. People aren't pushing back, quite as strongly from all sides as we've seen before. Whether or not that's a good thing, I don't know. You know, I think that more transparency is probably always better. But I think we've known for a few months now that we're just going to end up with what we end up with, and that's going to be decided by Obama and Boehner.
The Economic Policy Institute just last month put out a five-point suggestion, a five-point plan of its own, with suggestions such as these: create jobs now, let the Bush tax cuts expire, preserve and strengthen the Social Security safety net, return fairness and progressivity to the tax code, and tax goods and services that have significant social costs.
Yes.
Based on these planks in the economic platform from the Economic Policy Institute, as you monitor the discussions, the budget discussions between Boehner and Obama, how are they faring according to your five-point plan?
Sure. Well, yeah, I helped put together this plan. More than just principles, we actually put together a budget that goes out 25 years that does all these things, like which you said, which create jobs now, which let the Bush tax cuts expire, which preserve and strengthen the social safety net, return fairness and progressivity to the tax code, and tax goods and services that have social costs. So we did all of that in our plan, and as we show, we don't get to debt and deficit levels that would shock people. You know, we have a pretty responsible plan that does all of these things. In terms of how Obama and Boehner are doing on these things, I mean, I think Obama is, for all that we can be disappointed in what we hear from him, he is dedicated to job creation. And, it's going to be difficult to see what actually comes out of these negotiations and the impact that they'll have. But the fact that he's pushing for more stimulus, for an extension of unemployment benefits, and also for, an extension of the payroll tax holiday. These are cornerstones of what we need to create jobs now. He's got to fight John Boehner on each of these issues. So I wouldn't say Boehner is in that camp of creating jobs now. He's much more in the reduce spending now camp, which, as we know, would bring about austerity that would throw our economy back into recession. So Obama is, I believe, fighting to create jobs now, and having to fight Boehner pretty strongly on that. In terms of letting the Bush tax cuts expire, this is a policy that is written into law right now. Come January 1st, the Bush tax cuts will expire. That's what the law says. So any other action that happens on that will have to be legislated. I think Obama has the upper hand here, simply because it's written into law that they expire. If he wants to extend these tax cuts for middle-income earners, which low and middle-income earners, which EPI would support, he's going to have to present that to Republicans. It's going to be very difficult and look very bad for Republicans to refuse a tax cut on middle-income earners. So I think Obama's got the upper hand here, but we'll see. We've definitely heard various numbers thrown out in the last few days of John Boehner saying, well, I'll let the tax cuts expire for everyone over $1 million. I mean, that's a ridiculous stance to take. $250,000 is a lot of money, and that was Obama's initial stance. People making over that should see their tax cuts expire. Boehner's now saying, well, maybe I'll support it for people making over $1 million. Now we're seeing today that they might come to a middle ground of $400,000. This isn't going to raise a ton of revenue, but it's a starting point. I can't say it's something I would be happy with, But, you know, just to get those tax cuts to expire for those making over $400,000 would be a little bit of a start. But, again, you know, Obama's going to have to hash that out, and that's going to be a fight. As for preserving and strengthening our social safety net, I think this is probably the area where progressives will be most disappointed in what comes out of these negotiations. We have seen that the raising the Medicare eligibility age is likely off the table. That's a good thing. You know, we don't want seniors to have to wait more years to get Medicare, even with the Affordable Care Act. That would be a dangerous proposal. But what we are seeing is the White House softening to what's called change CPI, which is basically a different measure of inflation. It's a complicated topic to explain, but the effect would be that seniors would see their Social Security benefits growing more slowly over the years than they would otherwise. So this would impact especially people who live to be very old, you know, over 80. They would see lower benefits than they otherwise would. So Social Security advocates are very upset about this, and you know, I think that that's one of the things we may be likely to see come out of this deal. In terms of returning fairness and progressivity to the tax code, you know, I think that we don't even know what we're going to see on tax reform over the next year or two. This negotiation is just a starting point. I think that we may actually see some reform happen on tax expenditures in the next year or two there. They are very, very costly part of our tax code, and they primarily benefit upper-income earners. That's one of the areas where Republicans seem a little bit more willing to work together on tax reform. So we may see that. But initially, I'm not expecting a whole lot taxes in the income tax code. You know, we might see the Bush tax cuts expire for the very, very wealthy, but I'm not expecting much beyond that. And then taxing goods and services that have significant social costs, this is really just a dream of ours at EPI. You know, we want to see a carbon tax. We want to see a financial transactions tax. We'd like to see sweetened beverage tax and alcohol tax. These are all things that we believe, you know, are causing things in our society that cost money. You know, the carbon emissions is also really threatening our planet. So we believe that that taxing these can change behavior and also raise revenue. So that's something we'd like to see, but I don't think that has any place in the current negotiations.
To what degree is the focus on deficit reduction and tax cuts basically following the dictates of the Federal Reserve?
You know, that is a complicated question. I guess if you could clarify what you mean by the dictates, that would be helpful. But I think I have a few
I
ideas.
Go back to the Clinton administration when mm-hmm. Greenspan pretty much said, this is what you have to do. And Bill Clinton, who had actually campaigned on an entirely different, I suppose, a more progressive agenda, immediately adopted the debt reduction as the reason to exist and came in and did a number of changes to social programs in service of debt reduction, basically following the dictates of Greenspan. Bernanke, even before he took the position of chairman of the Fed, had said pretty much the same thing. Deficit reduction is the way to go. And now we have Barack Obama agreeing essentially that should be the focal point, although he ran too on a far more liberal agenda. So it seems to be the case that the Federal Reserve is playing a major role here, because we did see, and this is where Clinton learned a lesson, the Federal Reserve played havoc with Jimmy Carter's administration, and no president wants that to happen to him or her. So to what degree do you see a correlation between the way the Fed sees the economy and the way the president sees the economy?
Sure. Well, there definitely is a correlation between the way the Fed sees the economy and the president sees the economy. I do think that Clinton, you know, he presided over a much different time. If you'll remember, the unemployment rate dropped significantly over his tenure from about 7.5% to, I believe, around 4% at the end of his presidency. So he presided over a time of, very good economy, very low unemployment, and his focus on debt reduction is not justified. I think, you know, progressives would say we could have done much more in that time. But, you know, I think it makes more sense that he would have listened to someone who said, you know, now is the time to do this. We've got this great economy. Now, Obama does not have that economy. He does not have that unemployment rate. Whether or not, Obama's worry about deficits is driven by Bernanke or somebody else, I mean, I think there's more people than just Bernanke that he's appointed and worked with who have been what you might call deficit hawks. Peter Orszag comes to mind, his first director of the Office of Management and Budget, who's no longer with the administration. But Peter Orszag is he's a smart guy, but he's a centrist, and he's a deficit hawk. And I think that, that he certainly played a role in having Obama create that National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility, which is basically the Deficit Commission. Bernanke, I think, has actually been helpful to the recovery. I mean, the interest rates have remained very low. So I think, I'm not sure if the deficit, if the focus on debt and deficits is coming from Bernanke, though I do think that the Fed and the administration are close in that regard. It's a good question, but I think, Obama's back and forth on deficits versus job creation has a little bit to do with more conflict both within himself and within other people in the administration.
Well, thank you, Rebecca, for this briefing. I'm sure you're going to be monitoring this very closely. Hopefully, we could come back to you very soon when there is something called a budget.
Yep,
you'll be
definitely
able to decipher it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
thank
bye.
You. Well, that was Rebecca Thies of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., giving us a basic tour of what what we can expect or what we should be looking at as the talks proceed on the national budget. We'll take a break and come back right after this. Blakey and the Jazz Messengers with Monin. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we continue our journey today. We give a nod to Senator Daniel Inouye, who died at age 88. He was the second longest serving senator in the U.S. history in the U.S. Senate, after Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia. A good man, and the country's first Japanese-American senator. Re-elected 8 times, most recently 2 years ago in 2010. We have an interesting political development in that a Tea Party star is now going to be taking the place of Senator Jim DeMint in the U.S. Senate. He is an African-American and a Tea Party. I talk about a double whammy. He is a double whammy. Representative Tim Scott is going to be taking Jim DeMint's place. Jim DeMint has resigned in order to head up the Heritage Foundation. Now, what's significant about that is that it points to how, when you start a political movement, how you proceed. Now, it's a fairly short time since the Tea Party began and had gained momentum, but they're moving in a methodical way. And this is instruction for other parties, other movements. This is how they organize and this is how they move. So it's a very interesting thing that in a short time, they have now entered the arena at this level, at the U.S. Senate level. And of course, there's compatibility with the Republican Party. And so we will have a reinforcement of the Republican / Tea Party ideology prevailing, even in a small sense, even though they're vastly outnumbered. That is not important. What is important is it is an achievement for a political movement. Now, I'm not praising it and thinking it's a great thing, but I think it is a significant thing, and we ought to pay attention to that. Sister Hillary. Oh, Sister Hillary, Sister Hillary. Sister Hillary was supposed to be ready to testify before a congressional committee on December the 20th relating to the attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi, Libya. Well, she has a doctor's note. Since last week, it was known that she allegedly had a fainting spell at her home and in falling hit her head and had a concussion. She had to cancel all of the little trips that she was making abroad to save the world. And now she is indisposed and is ordered by her physician to stay at home and convalesce. And that is why she will not be available to the committee. A very typical Clinton move. She can't, the dog ate her homework is the next reason we would get for why Hillary Clinton is not ever going to be associated with the attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi. That was the work for Susan Rice to do. It destroyed her chances of being Secretary of State. And Hillary Clinton will leave smelling like a rose. This is what I mean. It's happening right in your face, you know. They don't even dress it up. You know, last week she had a concussion. She's in delicate shape. And the doctor says that she has to stay home and recuperate from her fainting spell fall. Well, okay. But mind you, this is the kind of contempt that the Clintons have had all along for process of accountability. She will not be made to account for this. She will not leave with any disparaging marks against her for her political afterlife, whatever that may be. She has received the report. This is the compilation of facts as they exist from the committee, gathering facts, talking to different people. She has the report, but she will not be testifying on the 20th. And the 20th is only a hop, skip, and jump away from the end of the year, which means it is very likely that she will not be testifying on Benghazi. No stench of failure will attach to her before she leaves office. Incredible. And speaking of the Clintons, on the other side, Bill Clinton is getting exactly what he wants, and that is posterity. Remember I talked to you about the fact that what presidents want more than anything after a while, especially if they had a second term, is posterity. They want to be known. They want history to record that they were superb people. And Martin Scorsese, the great film director, has decided that he will make a documentary about Bill Clinton for HBO. It will be financed by Mr. Bing, Steve Bing. You should know Steve Bing. It's like saying Facebook. Bing is a major financial contributor to the Clinton Foundation and also a major backer of Hillary Clinton's campaign for president and then for U.S. Senate. So he's finally going to be in league with the likes of Reagan, who had a documentary made about him, and George Bush, who had a documentary made about him. And now Bill Clinton is going to be cemented in film. Isn't that great? 1-888-874-4888. Give me a call and let's have a little chat about what's going on in your neck of the woods. 888-874-4888. It is an amazing thing how these Clintons function. I find them to be an extraordinary study in the art of prestidigitation. They conjure up a reality that really isn't a reality, but it becomes reality. They are fantastic at it. It is, of course, I think, a sad thing, and this is one of the faults I definitely attribute to Barack Obama, that basically he punked out on Susan Rice, his own nominee. And he just let this woman basically sink under the garbage that had nothing to do with her. And it's like, what else do you need? I mean, this was such a very bad thing. And it made him, in my eyes, it made him look really bad. Because he had said before, you know, if you're going to attack her, you've got to come through me, all this kind of talk. Basically, yes, they attacked her, and yes, they came through him. Now what? They eviscerated this woman. Hillary Clinton sails off into the sunset like nothing ever happened. And she actually even said, I am responsible. And people are saying, no, we can't allow you to be responsible. We've got Susan Rice. We're going to tear her to shreds, just eviscerate her reputation. Sarah from Dallas, thank you for joining us.
Greetings to you, Utreat.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Hello?
Are you there? Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear. I guess it was a time pause. I was saying greetings to you and good afternoon to you.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you. What I was calling about in regards to, you have several topics, but I'm going to quickly brush over them. The situation with Tim Scott, Black Tea Party member of South Carolina, and his appointment by the Indian American governor of South Carolina, I think it's all showcasing. The Republicans have to get a leg up, so they're going to take this black person, a Republican, to say that they're always the one to advance black people, and the Democrats, the Democratic Party, always like to show that they're all inclusive. But if you look at the track record from the introduction, Art Fletcher, who was a Republican under the Nixon administration that introduced affirmative action, as well as J.C. Watts, et cetera, to show that it was always Republicans who always advanced blacks into leadership position, to include Michael Steele, former chair of the RNC. So this is another case of another black being showcased for the Republicans. The situation with Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii that passed away, it just goes to show why these people need to have term limits. Here it is, this individual is 88 years old. As you said, he was elected to office 8 times, died in office, now the state of Hawaii is going to have to go into great expense to try and get someone to put elected, run a special election or whatever, to have them take over this position. There has to be a term limit, like we have Charlie Rangel and we have John Conyers, all of these individuals up in age who will end up dying at their death. This makes absolutely no sense. Going to office, you're still going to rise to prestige, you're still going to get your retirement. He was a Medal of Honor recipient, so he was pretty much set for life, the late senator that passed. So this makes no sense that we keep putting these people over and over into office, and they're not doing anything. I'm not saying that this person that transitioned didn't do anything for the state of Hawaii, but we have to have term limits, especially when your health is so poor. You should have stepped down a long time ago to enjoy your retirement rather than be sitting up there in political office.
Well, let me put it to you another way. What, therefore, do you say about the fact that people choose a particular candidate, and therefore if their choice is even a frail, sick person, that is also part of the democratic process? They can choose whoever.
It shows the status that we have attached to people, you treat. Like the same thing happened with Jesse Jr. out of Chicago, where the man never ran, never mounted any campaign, but because of name recognition, black folks felt as if though they had to go ahead and put him back into office, knowing he was under a cloud and the possibility exists that he was not going to sit in office come January. He was going to be indicted. They still did not use their noggin to decide to say, you know what, let's get someone else to sit in office, because this man is out on medical leave. He has a possibility of going to prison. We don't need to be putting ourselves into expense for any special election. Same with Hawaii. The man is a Medal of Honor recipient. They feel proud of him with the history with Japan and the so-called attacking of Pearl Harbor. And here it is, this Japanese-American served this country. He was elected to public office, yada, yada. So they are going off of that, but you have to look at the individual. He is in frail health. He's up in age. It's time for him to go and a new breed to come up in here to do the people's work. We've got to.
Well, yes. I mean, I could see that point, but I could also say, I mean, that's part of the yin and yang of politics. You have to also respect the decisions of his constituency. That's who they said they wanted. For whatever reason, that's who they said they wanted. I mean, the election wasn't rigged. Nobody strong-armed the people to say you have to vote for him. But as long as he was clear about his mission and the people were clear about their choice, we also have to, in this process, we have to also abide by the fact that people choose these individuals for whatever reason. When the folks elected Jesse Jackson Jr., although he had not been in office for at least almost a half of a year, with much of that without explanation. We had a similar situation in Harlem, albeit for very different reasons, where Adam Clayton Powell also was elected without even being in the United States. But that was a political decision. And the constituents chose to elect him because of the situation at the time. He was, in their minds, unfairly removed from his seat. He was unfairly put under a cloud. And they decided that the vote was therefore a political statement. All of these things are part of the mix of politics. I agree with you that there does come a time when for the sake of a constituency, people should make a different kind of choice. They should decide, well, I'm too old. It's time for somebody else. I should mentor somebody else to take my place. I mean, you would hope that they would come to that realization. But if they don't, and people say, well, this is who we want, that's part of the process, and we have to live with it.
Unfortunately, you treat it goes to voter education in this country, where we are very ignorant to the fact. We run on celebrity Hollywood version of the American Idol in putting people into elected office. and we are not looking at the big picture overall to say what it is that in the event of this person die in office, because I'm sure that when he ran on his last reelection campaign, they knew this man was up in age. He was 88 years of age. And they knew the possibility existed that he is going to die in office, plus he was going through medical issues. We have got, you know, we have got to educate the public. We are some dumb people.
But you're assuming something. One of the things that you're not assuming or not taking into consideration is the fact that age happens to be a very valued thing in Hawaiian culture. Hawaiians actually respect old age. The Japanese certainly do. So you may think, you know, well, he's too old. This is precisely what is valued in other cultures. He is an old person. He therefore is a wise person. He therefore is a decent man and would do the right thing. He hardly is the stuff that Hollywood is made of. He never behaved like that throughout his entire career. His career was one of sacrifice and noble aims and objectives, and that is revered in certain cultures. So that is also some of the things that, you know, we have to take these things into consideration. People value that. Plus, as old as he was, and as long as he had been in Congress, he was also able to wield his seniority to the advantage of his constituencies. So you have to look at this in a very different way. In the United States, youth is what's happening. In other cultures, youth is a thing to be wary of. You want to find a wise old person who would not be easily swayed by money or not be easily corrupted, who has a different set of values that go back a long way. So for many, in Hawaii especially, both on the cultural front of Hawaiians valuing age, the Japanese Americans valuing age, that might be a very strong plus in the consideration of Daniel Inouye, as old as he was, as a preferred choice. So thanks, Sarah.
You're so welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. You know, these are really good discussions. The choices people make in a democratic process, you have to weigh them on any number of levels, because you have to see how things play, how, you know, how it connects. The culture connects, age, which Americans really don't have very much use for. It's like, oh, he's old. I mean, he's therefore, senile. No, in many cultures, that's exactly what you want. You want a very wise old person who has a long and dedicated history of being of service to the people. And rather than vote for some unknown entity, they go with who they know. And you have to respect that. So keep your eyes on this budget process, because, again, I mean, I have some different thoughts about it, but it was good to get some kind of a grounding on where things stand, even at this point, as talks continue to hammer out something they call a budget. We don't know what it would look like until, you know, the package is delivered, and then it will be dissected to see when and where we suffer. But make no mistake, we're going to suffer. I know it. We are going to suffer. So keep your eyes on that. Let me see. Also, I enjoy getting your emails and your comments about the program and suggestions. I love it. Always feel free to drop me a note at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com, leadstories@gmail.com. So I'm going to leave you with a little bit more of Moanin', and I'm going to ask you to stay tuned right here on PRN.FM, because Jack Rasmus is up next with Alternative Visions. See you tomorrow.